Welcome to Speaking in Maine on MPBN. I'm Gordon Fellis. Today, our program will visit the University of Maine in Orono and a recent summit titled Advancing Maine, Aligning Academic Programs to Meet Future Workforce Needs. The speaker is John Dorer, Director of the Maine Department of Labor's Center for Workforce Research and Information. His talk will focus on trends and the future of Maine's workforce landscape and what can be done to meet those needs. Mr. Dorer was one of three featured speakers at the event. You can find video clips of all three speakers and the introductory remarks given by Governor John Baldacci online at www.maine.edu/system/advancingmaine.php. There's also a link to the videos on our website, mpbn.net, on the Speaking in Maine page under Audio on Demand. There, you'll also find this program and an archive of past Speaking in Maine programs, available to stream online or to download as podcasts, a service made possible by member support. Introducing the speaker is University of Maine System Board of Trustees member Charles O'Leary.
Representing the older group of Maine citizens, that growing segment of our population, over the years, I was very fortunate in my career to represent Maine workers. I met a great many people in the workforce and came to appreciate what each and every one of them did. And I know how important it is to have people that are helping to build that workforce. I had the good opportunity to work with our next speaker over a period of 30 years, an economist who the military would describe as boots on the ground. He got to know people that were unemployed, got to know the problems with retraining, got to know the problems of trying to find jobs for those people. I appreciated his work and the work of people like Chip Morrison, who served as the Commissioner of Labor, Laura Fortin, our Commissioner of Labor now. The work that they did in cooperating with the representative workers was very important. And one of the things I would encourage you to do today is to build stronger alliances with these people, with higher education and some of the people that are boots on the ground. It's going to make a major difference. John Dorer is an economist and a research administrator focused on workforce development, human capital, and labor market policies at the state and regional level. He is responsible for overseeing the state of Maine's statistical systems for measuring employment, unemployment, and labor market developments. John advises the governor, state legislature, and institutional and business leaders in Maine labor on markets, developments, workforce challenges, and is currently a member of the Maine Economic Growth Council. Prior to joining the Maine Department of Labor, he served as Deputy Director of the Workforce Development at the National Center on Education and the Economy in Washington, D.C., where he worked with leaders of America's largest cities and states in developing integrated workforce and economic development strategies. He spent 20 years in Maine as a senior vice president of Training and Development Corporation, a nonprofit organization focused on workforce and regional development. It is my great pleasure to welcome and introduce to you my friend and boots on the ground, John Dorer.
Charlie, I have to say that this is indeed an honor for me. Over the 30 years that I've known Charlie as an educator, as an advocate, as a board member, I learned a lot. I learned a lot from Charlie about fundamental commitment to economic fairness. And Charlie O'Leary is one accomplished individual in terms of advocating for the well-being of Maine workers, and I thank him for that. Thanks. This is tough duty. I am between two stellar speakers and lunch. And it feels to me a little bit like, the accountant from Arthur Anderson that they trot out at the Academy Awards. It's important information, but it's kind of there in the background. Let me try to take you on a voyage through some statistical information, I think, that builds upon the work and the foundation that Laurie has laid in terms of looking at what are the implications for workers and labor markets in particular, and what are some of the challenges that we confront. So let me begin. Demographics and the workforce are something that we have to really concentrate on with great urgency. While the U.S. workforce will continue to increase in size, but it will be at a considerably slower rate than it has in the past. In the 1970s, when Charlie and I first worked together, the workforce was growing by 2.6%. It's when baby boomers came in, and basically you couldn't create jobs fast enough to absorb the people that were coming in. That growth rate slowed significantly, about 1.1% in the 90s, and about that same rate from 2000 to 2010. So we really cut it in half in terms of the growth of the labor force. As we look out at the next decade, that labor force growth rate is projected to be 0.4% and 0.3%. Those, to me, are rather anemic numbers. I mean, this is not robust growth, as some would say. So we are looking at labor force growth that is really quite slight. What does this mean for Maine? Well, as we look at labor force growth in Maine from the 40s up through the projections for 2000-2016, as you can see, we've had some tremendous decades and very dramatic increases in labor force growth. 2006 to 2016, 5%, and in about a month's time, as we come out with our new forecast for 2008 to 2018, you'll see an even much more reduced number in terms of labor force growth. So Maine's labor force is not going to be growing in the way that we historically have, and I think that's an important foundation piece, has important implications for the university. Another phenomenon seems to have topped out. One of the other tremendous developments over from the 1950s to 2000 was a very significant increase in female labor force participation. Female labor force participation rates moved from 30% to about 60% over that time span. So not only did we have the baby boomer population, but females in the labor force in that population dramatically increased their labor force participation, helping to contribute to that labor force growth. What we are now seeing is that women seem to be backing off somewhat from that high level of labor force participation rate for a number of reasons. Some are lifestyle choices. Some are economic choices. If we put propositions forward of offering low-wage jobs and high-cost daycare, people are good economists. They can figure that out. Another phenomena that we've seen some leveling off on is older male workers, particularly those older male workers who basically got kicked out of the manufacturing economy. They hit that point 50, 55, and their skill sets are terribly mismatched with where the economy is going. And many, many of those folks basically have to struggle to make it to the finish line of drawing a Social Security check and getting Medicaid. And so they've reduced their labor force participation. Although, I think out of economic necessity at this point, we're starting to see some turnaround in what older folks are doing. It's absolutely out of sheer economic necessity. Pay attention to your grocery checkout counter, your fast food establishments, and look who's behind the counter these days. Young, energetic teenagers are increasingly being replaced by older folks. And let me tell you, they're not there for a hobby. They're up there because they have to struggle to earn a living. So those are some of the developments. The labor force in Maine will increasingly become more gray. And again, as we look at this out past 2016, a larger share of our labor force will be in that 55-plus category. And as Laurie indicated, that's not necessarily a death sentence. It is absolutely an opportunity, and any corporate HR department that's right now not able to be creative in terms of HR strategies for keeping older workers engaged, I think is going to miss out on a huge opportunity. Walk through the sales floor of L.L. Bean. We have probably the most highly educated sales workforce in the world working at L.L. Bean today, and they're working for lifestyle reasons, they're working for discounts, they're working for a lot of reasons, but it's a model of engaging that older workforce. Now, how is this demographic phenomenon playing out for us in terms of industry sectors? Maine's most educated and skilled workers are heading towards the exits. This gives you a distribution by age and sex of the workers in professional, scientific, and technical services. So this is basically Maine's most educated workers. And when we take a look at how demographically they stack up, we find that close to 40% are heading towards those retirement gates and are going to leave exit stage right. Now, what is going to happen is many of these workers, because they've had higher incomes, had more generous benefits, are going to be more likely to afford to retire. They may not want to hang around, certainly not want to hang around on a full-time basis. And again, if our institutions don't quickly adapt and figure out how do we accommodate these kinds of individuals who are with lots of knowledge, lots of skills, lots of network connections, we miss out potentially on a very, very important labor pool that we need to keep very much engaged. The same is true as we look at ambulatory healthcare service. Again, it's a female-dominated industry, but it's an industry that's aging in place. And this is some new data set, and I'd like to invite some of the academic researchers to begin to exploit this a little bit more, because what we dutifully do here in Maine, every quarter we send up wage records, which is the footprints of Maine workers, where they work and where they at what kind of industries they work. And we send it off to the Census Bureau, and we match it up with Social Security data on age and sex, and increasingly more refined detail about the characteristics of workers, and that's where this comes from. We need to do more research in it. And one of the things we need to exploit, this is employee turnover by age and sex in professional, scientific, and technical services. So we're able to, with a little bit better precision than we ever have, we're going to be able to take a look at industries in Maine to find out when this exiting process is occurring and who's exiting and what counties they're exiting and what industries they're exiting from. And again, I think as the university engages in this kind of planning to align its way to the economy, consulting this kind of data is going to be critically important. Now, again, for comparison purposes, when we look at the demographics of Maine manufacturing workforce 1997 and 2007, again, you can clearly see that Maine's manufacturing workforce is aging very dramatically. And while, yes, we have far fewer manufacturing workers, but again, our output levels have held up pretty good. There's been a tremendous productivity accomplishment in manufacturing. The kind of people working in the manufacturing sector are increasingly high-skilled, high-performance, and we increasingly need to back them up with, I think, an education system that fits the kinds of skills that they need to perform those jobs if we want to have a robust and growing manufacturing economy, recognizing that workforce reductions will still be part and parcel of that kind of wrenching adjustment that's going on. Now, as we engage in the analysis of trying to project occupational outlook, looking for the period 2006 to 2016, what you see here is the spectrum of major occupational groupings that we have in the state of Maine. And with the exception of one, health support occupations, the rest of the occupations, really the openings that we anticipate over this projections period, will be largely due to replacement. So even if we have anemic slow growth, which is in the cards, I think we're going to be looking to have to replace a whole lot of folks, and this is what this data shows us. And I think we need to be very attentive, because this problem of replacement is not easily accomplished. I mean, you don't put in a call to Hollywood casting and say, give me five more dentists tomorrow, I need five more RNs. This is a supply chain. This is what has to happen in our K-12 system, in our post-secondary system, coordinated over periods of time. We need lead time. We need investment. We need to solve this problem with strategy, sustained commitment, and I think what this data can help us do is focus on where the needs are going to be so that we're not getting caught short. My fear right now in Maine is we potentially could find ourselves being caught short, not being able to replace critical people that are walking off center stage from this economy, and that the risk for Maine is that it could, in effect, fall backwards due to benign neglect. The benign neglect that comes from underinvesting in human capital. The biofuel to run the main economy is refined here in campuses across the state. It's refined in our K-12 education system. And if we don't produce that fuel, we will not run this economy. This economy will run on human capital. That's what will produce growth. Now, there's also, as part of this demographic, changing phenomena. This takes a look at community colleges attracting more older students. Looks at from 2001 up through 2009, and this typically happens when an economy goes down. Many of those older workers are coming back in and looking for educational opportunity. We need to create institutions, and we need to create skill development enterprises that are hospitable to those adults returning. And we need not to see that as a recessionary phenomenon. I think this is really part and parcel of the kind of economy that we're going to have. There's lots and lots of displacement, and there is a need for reskilling and rebuilding people as they basically exhaust one career and have to move on to another. We need to create an infrastructure that is very hospitable to that kind of behavior. Quickly, the trends and implications of all this. Employees are going to be working in more decentralized, specialized firms, employer-employee relationships, much less standardized, much more individualized. There's a renegotiation going on, some good, not so good, some not so good, but we need to be thinking about a different work environment and a different kind of attitude and set of relations. Slow labor force growth will encourage employers to adapt approaches to facilitate greater labor force participation among women, the elderly, and people with disabilities. For years, that we've left a lot of people on the margins, and we left them behind because the economy didn't need them. I think we have to rethink that. I think we really have to re-engage in taking a look at people who have been marginalized historically and figure out a way to deal them in. Because as you can see from the kind of labor force growth rate that we're projecting, and demographics are one of the best predictors of the future. So what we're able to glean from that is that we need to be able to leave no one behind in Maine because they have extraordinary economic value for the future. Now, let's shift on the demand side a little bit and look at the economic dynamics in the labor market ahead. I think we heard this morning the kind of sort of economic environment that Doug Hall is talking about. You know, increasingly, that's no longer going to be the exception. It's the norm for if we want to get economic performance. So an accelerated pace of technological change and this unrelenting globalization that we've been a part of is going to continue. And again, rather than figuring out how do we avoid it, I think we need to figure out how do we build our institutional capacity, our infrastructure, our psyche, and our temperament around living with this reality. And we need to adjust accordingly. From the standpoint of supporting this, program development and planning that is got to be undertaken by institutions, not only higher education, but across the public sector. Institutions have to realign and refigure. What we're able to contribute to that is data on employment, wages, market demand, and projections for growth ahead. So we've got things to work with, resources to work with, informational resources, more and better resources than we've ever had. Of the top 10 fastest-growing occupations 2008 to 2018, 7 require a bachelor's degree or higher. So clearly, amongst the fast-growing occupations, education is the key to, in effect, getting on board and getting on that train. Biomedical engineers, network systems and data communications analysts, biochemists, as you can see for yourself, 7 out of 10 requiring bachelor's or degrees or higher. So clearly, this is a direction that our economy is moving in. Now, as we take a look at job openings by educational level 2008 through 2018, this is a pretty formidable set of numbers. Master's degree and above, we're looking at nearly 5 million job openings, with, by the way, the bulk of those coming from this replacement phenomenon that we're talking about. Bachelor's degrees, well in excess of 11 million jobs. Again, the bulk of those due to replacement, although there's significant growth. I don't want to leave out what we have on the bottom, in that still roughly about 17 million jobs in the economy are going to get opened up for people with high school diplomas. We need to be equally attentive across the spectrum of our educational system to ensure that people moving through these systems come out at the other end with higher skill sets, with greater competency than they ever had before. Because the nature of workplaces, again, is changing, and it's requiring more from all of us. There's more self-agency, there's more complexity in all kinds of work environments, and I think it's very important that as we tackle this subject of building the skill sets of the workforce, that we don't leave people who don't access the higher education systems behind, because they too need to perform, and as you can see, they will be out there still in sizable numbers. Now, occupational clusters with the most intensive concentrations of post-secondary workers. When we take a look at science, technology, engineering, mathematics, and social sciences, the STEM disciplines, 93% will basically require workers with intensive concentration in post-secondary education. So if we want to have a STEM-driven economy, it's going to absolutely need to be fueled by people with post-secondary education and credentials. Education and training occupations, 93%. Health practitioners and technicians, 92%. Community services, 89%. And managerial and professional occupations at 83%. These are going to be the big consumers of degree talent in our economy. We've taken a look a little bit more deeply from the standpoint of STEM careers in the state of Maine and STEM-related skills, and what we initially analyzed across the spectrum of industry categories is that on the whole, all industries, about 3.3% of the STEM occupations in an employment in all industries are going to be STEM occupations, mostly concentrated in business and professional services, information services, public administration, and manufacturing, which I think shows the transformation of what we mean these days by a manufacturing sector. Now, we did something a little different. We said, okay, if we have these STEM occupations, we know something about the skill sets that these STEM occupations require, and let's take that data about the knowledge, skills, and abilities that are directly associated with STEM occupations, and let's take a look at and see whether we can find these skill sets in related kinds of occupations. And so through this kind of skill transferability analysis, which we're becoming more enthusiastic by, you start to begin to see some changes. So what basically, when we look at the disciplines associated in the definitions of STEM occupation, shows 3.3% in all industries, moves up to 13.3% when we look at those related skill sets. So it's not necessarily sort of worshiping a label, as we often tend to do, but I think digging a little bit more deeply beneath the obvious and saying, well, it's really about skills. It's really about the capabilities of individuals to perform, and when we use that metric, we start to, in effect, show a much larger concentration of workers. And again, for effect, I work with Laurie on the Economic Growth Council. If we want to push that income data up, the more of these kinds of jobs, which tend to be high wage, the better off we're going to be. I mean, there is no silver bullet. There's nothing but hard work to educate, to train, to power up our human capital that's going to drive up income. And this, again, gives you a picture of what the wage landscape looks like for STEM and STEM-related skills across the spectrum of industries and the economy. Switch gears a little bit. Another phenomenon that I think is in everybody's vocabulary these days is green jobs. And we are, I tell you, struggling mightily to try to arrive at answers to the question of green jobs. And the approach that we're taking, I think, is a rather conservative one. We're taking a look and finding out who are companies that are doing green-related work. We initially went with broad industry classification. It didn't lead us very far. Where we're at right now on our odyssey in terms of identifying the main green economy is basically having identified about 2.7% of private employment as being green on the basis of what companies do. And that's in the area of renewables, energy efficiency, and environmental conservation related activities. And this is a work in progress, so I don't stand up here with a great deal of confidence that we've got this figured out, but we are spending a considerable amount of time with people from the industry, a lot of time talking with folks about the transformation that's underway. We've moved it up a couple of notches and said if it's not particularly green by way of a strict definition, are there stakeholders? So another 2.8% we consider stakeholders. So again, 5.5% is what we sort of take right now as a number of what we would consider green jobs. A lot of work underway in terms of, okay, occupations, and I think these are important implications for academic planning and the university. The Department of Labor and something called the Occupational Network has really has just gone through an examination of occupations in the U.S. economy to try to come up with their definition of what is green. And basically, in terms of this examination that they've done, and this is about to be rolled out in the way that the Bureau of Labor Statistics gathers data, so we're about to get some good numbers around these things. Take a look at research, design, and consulting services. Clearly, the largest concentration of where we're going to find these green occupations. And what the folks did at the Department of Labor, they classified these occupations into three categories. They looked at traditional occupations that will simply have increased demand, traditional occupations that will have enhanced skills, and then they came up with a clump of occupations that they consider truly new and emerging. So in the area of research, design, and consulting services, followed very closely again by manufacturing, which I think is a very realistic portrayal of where this action is moving. This is how we're going to be doing our accounting around green occupations and green jobs. Part of this analysis comes from on-the-ground work that is done looking at occupations, reviewing those occupations, and through panel studies, keeping an updated tally of increased demand, enhanced skills, and new and emerging kinds of occupations. Another critical development I think that we've got to pay attention to as part of this planning effort, and that is, and Laurie's alluded to this, the structure of the main economy is changing. And this is taking a look at what's happened to workers by size classes. And clearly, when we take a look at firms of a size 20 to 49, this is where the workers are concentrated. So smaller establishment sizes. I think we're down to about 83 establishments in Maine that have more than 500 workers in them. That means high degrees of specialization, internal labor markets, career ladders, once all part and parcel of a organized, industrialized economy, are no longer the norm. We are increasingly a company, a state of small firms, and in those kinds of companies, what you need is you need lots of Doug Hulls. You need lots and lots of folks who are nimble, who are adaptable. We are often challenged in trying to classify an occupation for somebody that tells us that they handle all the customer service calls. On the side, they maintain the local area network of computers that are being used in the business. On weekends, they run QuickBooks and do the accounting. And they also are responsible for taking out the trash every day. And that's not an atypical kind of situation. And the challenge becomes, how do we, in effect, build a workforce that is, in effect, comfortable and capable to function in that kind of environment in getting a result? And I think increasingly we need to look at those environments. We need to learn from those environments. We need to listen to the people who run those environments and begin to marry that kind of data together with how we're reshaping our educational system. Again, same variation. Percent of workers by size class, clearly those 20 to 49 size employers are what's going to drive the main economy ahead. Now, another little piece of work that we've been doing at the Department of Labor is taking a look at new business starts. And trying through a longitudinal tracking, kind of learn a little bit more about this whole creation process of new businesses. And so this is a slice of data which showed basically for the fourth quarter of 2005 the number of new business establishments that started and what their level of employment was at the time that this start occurred. For years, I mean, we at the Department of Labor were getting administrative records when an employer moves up to the level of running a payroll. What we don't have here is the 1099 sole proprietor. What this is about somebody who's interested in the payroll. So we said, look, let's convert this into economic intelligence. So this allows us to track, and as you can see, while we lose the number of companies over the course of a year, we gain about 7% in the form of employment as these companies, in effect, start to get their feet on the ground. A 7% increase in employment over the course of the year, pretty impressive over what the rest of the economy is doing. And again, learning more and getting down and gritty into the dynamics of how businesses start and how they behave during that start stage, how do we support that, is something we really need to learn a lot more about, both from the perspective of the workers and both from the perspective of the entrepreneurs who start that. And again, this kind of data helps us to do that. In terms of these new businesses, 20% of them were in professional, scientific, and technical services. So again, this is where the action is. This is where this kind of activity starts to gin up. And again, as we look at all of these developments, be they green, be they small business development, be they the economy in general, we know that in Maine, most high-growth, high-wage jobs will be filled by workers with at least some post-secondary education. Bachelor's degree or higher, 45.4%. So we've got to pay attention to creating this supply chain. And it is about a supply chain, because I don't think you can simply build a higher ed system without attending to a K-12 system that, in effect, produces the students that come here. They come here either prepared or not prepared as they need to be, and that has a lot of very important implications for what Maine's human capital landscape is going to look like. So we need to pay attention to the whole deal. And I think the theme coming through in this conference over and over is the synergy, the interdependence, the nature of collaboration that needs to take place. Only way we're going to get any results. Now, let me shift gears a little bit and go into a new arena that I think is very exciting and offers lots of possibilities. We at the Department of Labor have not sat still. We've invested in new data systems, and there are some new ones that are pretty exciting, and I'm very excited about, and to show you at least some of the output that we are able to get. Used to be that we took a good look in the rearview mirror, and we could tell you what happened 3 years ago with some lack of reliability. It's a problem. People didn't particularly appreciate that. They said, look, we need current data. We need to have a look, see at the economy, where it's heading now. We've entered into a deal with the conference board that is, in effect, engaged in the business. Again, it's a business out of necessity as their help-wanted advertising index collapsed around them because newspapers were no longer a source of listing job postings. They needed to get on board a whole new economic indicator source. And so what they did is they teamed with a company called Wanted Technologies, which scrapes about 1,900 job boards across the country. And it includes everything, by the way, from Monster to Craigslist to Jobs and Me to the job board that we run at the Maine Department of Labor. So it's an aggregator of that kind of data, creates huge, huge databases, takes those data sets and brings them in, eliminates the duplications, and then gives us a set of very good analytics to be able to track what employers are signaling in terms of labor demand. And so I'll give you some illustrations of how this is looking in Maine. The top chart shows for computer and mathematical occupations, for the last 16 weeks, what in effect has been the unduplicated job ads posting. And then the bottom chart that you see here gives you a four-year time series of what, in effect, employers are posting, have been posting in terms of jobs. And as you can see, as we look at this data over particularly right now in the month of February, we had 1,032 computer and mathematical occupations posted. 366 computer support specialists, 165 computer systems analysts, 87 computer software engineers in the applications area. This kind of data gives us a feel now, and it's often the case when we have this kind of economic downturn, we get very despondent, there's no demand, and there is no action in the labor market. Well, in effect, it is. I mean, the numbers that we report to you every month are net numbers, and what's masked often is a whole lot of transactions that take place in the labor market. This new data system gives you the ability to take a look at what those transactions look like. So from the university standpoint, not that this is, you know, the be-all, end-all in terms of input, I think it's an important one. It's an important input in terms of showing real-time demand, where does hiring take place. This is, again, a picture of architecture and engineering occupations. 83 electrical engineers, 69 industrial engineers, 563 architectural and engineering jobs in the month of February posted in the main economy. And down the list it goes as to the kinds of jobs that we've got. Business and financial, 656 total job postings. Life, physical, and social science occupations, 252. And not to leave the artists out, art, design, entertainment, sports, and media, 360 occupations, including things like merchandise displayers, window trimmers, public relations specialists. So we cover the spectrum. The data is place-based. So with this kind of database and this kind of data system, we can tell you where these jobs are located. We can tell you who's posting these jobs. And as you can see, you can get a perspective of this data over time so that we can have some confidence. So we're not making decisions based upon anecdotes or pleas, as often happens. Somebody says, oh, you can't do this. You know, I know there's no demand for this. This starts to make all of this process a little bit more honest. Market-based transactions data drawn from the internet, analyzed, and put into context. And so an extremely useful tool for planning purposes. Now, we're marrying this together with some new software that we've just acquired at the Department of Labor, artificial intelligence software from a company called Burning Glass out of Boston, where we're able to go down and dig into those job postings themselves as data, and we're able to dig into resumes that are posted on job banks as well, and begin to shape pictures of supply and demand balances, as is sort of demonstrated in the marketplace. And while, you know, this is not an absolute foolproof, I mean, there's a lot of hiring that gets done off the books and a lot of internal hiring that gets done, mining and exploiting the internet and using transactions-based data to, in effect, create economic intelligence on a fast turnaround, to me, is an innovation worthwhile believing in, because I think it really does bring us closer to understanding demand, and especially as we make increasingly better analytics out of this kind of data to be able to assess what's going on. Now, the point of this artificial intelligence software is to be able to parse, because not only do we have the title, we have the job postings themselves. So we have a rich database of what employers are asking for: knowledge, skills, abilities, certifications, educational requirement. And so we're able to, what has been for years, mountains of qualitative data went largely unexamined, we're able to convert that into data and be able to say something about the skill signaling that employers are making. As you can see, this, by the way, is data from New York State. This is not Maine data, but this is just to illustrate for you how this tool works. Communication skills, by far, the skill sets in greatest demand. Organizational skills, analytical skills, verbal communication skills, management skills. I mean, those are up there in terms of the kinds of skill sets that employers are signaling that they're looking for from a workforce. Skill requirements for IT jobs. Again, communication skills rank highly. It also begins to tell us a little bit more about the technical requirements that employers are looking for. And again, not a be-all, end-all, and I don't want to make that case, but I think it's an important consideration as we're doing this kind of planning of aligning education and the economy. This is a data source, I think, that we can draw into this process. We also do job vacancy surveys, and so labeled it for 2009, tail end of 2009. Take a look at where job vacancies occur in the main economy, and not unexpected, personal care, healthcare practitioners, healthcare support are amongst the highest job opportunities with vacancies on the list. In terms of what that looks like, the 2009 job vacancy survey, who would have thunk it that at the tail end of 2009, when the main economy was not particularly impressive, I'd say, we had 10,900 job openings that we gathered over a two-week period of doing this kind of survey. 1,300 of those as healthcare practitioners at the high end, 303 in management, 194 business and financial, architectural engineering, 147. Again, this is just sort of backup data. And while vacancy rates have gone down somewhat as a result of bad economy, we still have a labor market that has vacancies out there. And it's been more than a few times that we've gotten some frustrated employers calling us and saying, look, we can't find the people with the right skills, in spite of the fact that what's the story? We've got an 8.3% unemployment rate, and we can't match up the people with the right skill sets. Educational requirements for main job vacancies for healthcare practitioners, 30% bachelor's degrees, another 15% advanced degrees. So again, we learn from this data. This data needs to be applied in the context of building and forming strategies for our human capital institutions. Now, as we kind of bring all of this together, aligning education and the economy, we've got some established taxonomies. We're further along than we all might think. In terms of linking education and the economy, there's two coding systems that really begin to integrate this and bring it together. On the education side, we can take degree programs and translate them into classifications of instructional programming, which are called SIPs. On the economy side, we can take occupations through a standard occupational classification system. And now what we're able to do by linking the classification of instructional programs, standard occupational classification, we're able to build a common language between education and the economy. And I think we need to take advantage of how this taxonomy works for us and need to align. We have on the back of the wall, and Constance Bodine and my staff, who had a great deal of to do with making these happen, some charts where we took some data on the top degree output programs from the university system. We looked at the number of completers over the years. We looked at employment levels. We looked at wage levels. We looked at help wanted advertising that's associated with the occupational clusters. We threw everything up on the wall, if you will, just to kind of give people an idea of the wealth and depth of information that's out there to be able to do this kind of analysis. And here's what we came up with. This is lots of numbers to digest, and I won't bore with a lot. But this basically gives the top ranked by output in terms of the degree programs, employment projections, completers and grads that are entering the labor market, and below for those degree programs, we did a little calculation of the labor market entrants, what percent of employment they represent in 2008. And then we have the volume of wanted advertising index. So I'm sometimes confronted by frustrated parents whose daughter has just completed the university and is living in the basement at home, upset because there's no jobs. And, you know, I think there are jobs out there. I mean, there clearly are requirements to land them. This is not, in effect, an automatic match. But anyway, this begins, at least from a numerical standpoint, putting some of the data together. And all this data begs lots and lots of analysis. And you know, one of my missions today is hopefully engage some of the social scientists and some of the educational researchers in the university system to join us and take a look at this vast mountain of data that we're sitting on. And do a more deeper look-see at what does it mean, what is it telling us. Again, this is a little schematic of by the major degree output, what's been happening to the volume of completers in relation to the want ads, job postings that are out there, just to kind of get a sense of the relationship. So let me sort of sum at this point and talk about this next economy that you've heard a lot about today. You've gotten a good feel for, I think, what's going to emerge. I mean, clearly, as things are evolving, it is a science and knowledge economy. We need scientific and technological literacy in order to run it. It's a resource-challenged economy, and we need more critical thinking about sustainable economies because we can't wreck the place any more than we have. It's a globally interdependent economy, and by now that ought to be clear. We are no longer alone. We no longer own the world landscape. We've got to, in effect, work collaboratively with a whole lot of folk that we've never worked collaboratively with before. It's demographically diverse, and we've got to get very, very literate and very conversant in terms of cross-cultural leadership skills. And it's an innovation-driven economy. That drove that home. Requires students who can learn how to learn and adapt to rapid change. When the Conference Board surveyed employers just last year, what employers ranked as very important, skills for new entrants with four-year college diplomas, at the very top of the listing as a result of the survey, oral communications, teamwork, professionalism, work ethic, written communications, critical thinking, problem solving, writing in English, English language, reading comprehension, ethics and social responsibility, and leadership. I think these are good guides. So anyone that fears that this is about vocationalizing the academy, I think needs to listen to what employers are saying. I think employers are saying, we want this. And to me, taking Doug's advice, this is going to take a collaborative effort and working across disciplines in ways that we have not done so before in order to achieve that kind of output. Why invest in your future? If there's any poster or any placard I could put on top of Maine high schools, it's this one, which basically shows the relationship between the percentage of unemployment the red line, so the more education you have, the lower your unemployment rate. The green line, the more education you have, the more your weekly earnings. Maybe a tattoo would work on this. And finally, the road ahead. It's a challenging one. Future supply of college graduates. This is something that we used to own. We were the dominant supplier, and we owned the landscape. In 2003, China put out under a million college graduates a year. European Union, about 1.8 million. We in the United States put out about 1.3 million college graduates a year. In 2010, the Chinese will put out about 2.9 million. The European Union about 2.1, the U.S. about 1.8. By 2015, China will graduate about 4.8 million college graduates a year, European Union about 2.5 million plus, and the U.S. about slightly under 2.5 million. Now, the response I always get back is, but you don't understand, on a per capita basis, we're way ahead. Doesn't matter. Human capital can do great things. The more educated, the more skilled, the more qualified, the more thriving an economy that you're going to have. We're up against it in that we've got an economy that's transforming. We've got a society that's in kind of a funk and that we don't really know what next. And I think the kind of groundswell that, in terms of what it's going to take, I think one more time draws upon what is the best of the American character. Sometimes it takes us a long time, and it takes us to be really up against the wall before the best in us comes out. And I think that's where we're at. So thank you.
Time for a question or two. John, I was wondering, most of the professions you showed, including there, have certain kinds of university degrees attached.
Right.
Most of the skills you showed have different university
right.
degrees attached. I was wondering, to what extent, when you do these surveys, do you do surveys not only about STEM professions, but things like modern languages or history or things like that? And the reason I ask that is because, of course, the rich tend frequently to send their kids to liberal arts colleges to study those things, and
mm-hmm.
the rich are probably no stupider than the rest of us. So they must think those have something to do with professions, and yet in almost all your statistics except one, most of the liberal arts is left out.
Well, I think I don't necessarily agree with your premise that those skills don't get taught in these other disciplines. I think that's really a challenge for education, is to make sure that those skills aren't exclusive or, in effect, set apart from the rest. I think they need to be part and parcel of the curriculum. Yeah, yeah.
To what extent do you look for those that wider range of programs in your surveys? What you have are voice of
right.
the customer surveys, and Doug warned us about those today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But to what extent, because voice of the customer tends not to be where all you want, I'm wondering, to what extent do you look for other kinds of data?
Well, I mean, what we looked at is the top completions at the university. There's a lot more to look at, and we could take a look at those completers in other programs. We have a very robust means of taking a look at how this all plays out in the labor market. And I think we're about to launch, if Maine wins on this state longitudinal grant application, where we're going to bring together K-12, post-secondary, and workforce data to begin to take a look at how this all plays out in the labor market. So it really won't matter whether you're a graduate of a music program or whether you're a graduate of a French program. How are you ultimately faring in the labor market is what we're interested in. And we found that out a few years back when I think Don Zillman was the acting provost at the time, and I was on a little assignment up here. We had a challenge because there was a lot of dissatisfaction about the university not producing enough computer science graduates. And as we took a closer look at this phenomena and tried to answer that question, it turned out it wasn't quite as simple. Yes, we weren't, in relation to simple degree output, producing enough computer science graduates. But as it turned out, a lot of students that entered into computer science after year one or year two fanned off into music, architecture, English, all kinds of interesting travels in terms of their academic experience, but really maintained a pretty hardcore interest in applying computer technology and doing programming and gaining a skill sets that they were acquiring in a self-directed fashion on their own. So do we count those folks at the end of the day as part of the university's output in terms of computer science? No. Do these people come in and jump in and become the web designers and maybe handle networks and all kinds of interesting applications? Yes. I mean, that's exactly what's happening in the economy. And so I think what we need to do is begin to take a look as people come through the educational program and personally, I don't particularly care where they come from as long as they come out competent and having these high-order competencies that we need, to see how effective a performer they become. How effective a performer they become, how effective they are at earning livelihoods that give them the ability to make choices in life. And I think that's where we need to concentrate our assessments, need to concentrate our metrics. It's about getting results. It's about, in a period that plays out over a longer period of time, seeing how people adjust and how productive people become.
Hi. Just a question. One of the things as the University of Maine, as we bring in out-of-state students to Maine, we find that a very high percentage stay in Maine. So I'm just curious about your reflections on how we proactively shape the economy of the future in the sense of through education, looking out ahead, and then educating the students so we have a new labor force in a new sector mm-hmm. that then brings, theoretically, the employer and the jobs?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think we have to definitely take much more of a human capital orientation. I mean, we spend a lot of money promoting industrial incentives. We have business magazines that advertise 100,000 square foot Butler buildings as supposed enticements to get employers to move here. Now, market cubic feet of air in Maine, I've never quite gotten that strategy. What we need to start doing is, in effect, show what's the talent that we've got in the pipeline. And we need to put that up on our websites. We need to show that Maine is growing these kinds of skills in this kind of setting. They're coming out with these kinds of competencies. They're, in effect, working in these kinds of project-based settings, in these kinds of innovation settings. That needs to be part of our promotion. That is a message that needs to be put on websites. It needs to be put into the hands of site locators. It needs to be how we push this state along. So I think that's really something that we have to work on together, because I think we've got some very outdated and outmoded notions of economic development, which is around creating cash incentives, tax incentives, building incentives. 70 to 80% of the cost of doing business is on the labor that you're going to hire and on the talent that you're going to get. So we ought to advertise it, promote it, and turn this whole thing around from a, in my view, very wrong direction that's moving in.
We have time for one more.
I believe that a growing percentage of the workforce is independent contractors, creative people, consultants. Many of those folks could live anywhere.
Yep.
Maine has historically been an attractive destination for people like that, such as E.B. White, who wrote for The New Yorker and lived here. What are you looking at that
we are.
Component, and are you looking at the factors that might make Maine an attractive place for them, such as broadband access and air transportation, that sort of thing?
We are looking at that phenomenon in a couple of ways. One is the abuses in that system of people who are being hired as consultants who then walk into our unemployment office saying, where's my unemployment insurance, when, in fact, they worked for the same employer over and over again. So that's one kind of challenge on the downside. But on the upside, there are, more free agents that happen to live here. And as far as, some of our basic challenges of counting employment, this phenomenon of people who work here and are payrolled wherever is challenging fundamental employment numbers that we've got. We've had a breakthrough as of late in that we at the Department of Labor have landed some data from the IRS. We're going to be able to take a closer look at the issuances of 1099s, who they're being issued to, what the activities of those folks are, to be able to understand this phenomenon a little bit better. Because as I think Mike Levert will tell you, the quality of place phenomena is real. It is something that Maine has to trade on. And if we can get income generators, income producers, that in effect work out and bring money in, I think that's a good thing.
Thank you very much, John.
You've been listening to John Doerr, Director of the Maine Department of Labor's Center for Workforce Research and Information on Speaking in Maine. He was one of three featured speakers at the University of Maine in Orono and a recent Advancing Maine Summit. You can find video clips of all three speakers and the introductory remarks given by Governor John Baldacci online at www.maine.edu/system/advancingmaine.php. There's also a link to the videos on our website, mpbn.net, on the Speaking in Maine page under Audio on Demand. There, you'll also find this program and an archive of past Speaking in Maine programs, available to stream online or to download as podcasts, a service made possible by member support. Charles Beck is the executive producer of the program. For Speaking in Maine, I'm your producer and host, Gordon Fellis.